All right, so we are settling in. So if you came expecting to see, I've deployed Operations Manager APM, now what? You're in the right place. My name is Pete Zerger. I am a cloud and data center MVP, a consultant focusing on System Center, going way back with Operations Manager to .old.
Right, and my name is Alex Fedotev, and I'm a sales engineer with AppDynamics.
So, well, that's hardly a real introduction for Alex. So let me tell you a little bit about Alex Fedotev. So Alex was an architect with a company called Avicode. And Alex traveled the world implementing Avicode in some of the largest environments, some of which you may have heard of, like Xbox. So Alex brings with him a tremendous amount of experience today. This is really a special time because he's here and really keen to show you not so much about Avicode architecture and feature deep dives that you've done earlier this week. He really wants to show you how to implement and integrate Avicode into your processes to really leverage the tool in a proactive way that you might not be able to do in your current environment. So you see here some related sessions. Feel free to go back and visit those later. Like I said, we're not going to touch on the architecture, but we'll be showing you more of the how-to, not the what. And that being said, there's an assumption here that that you've installed the APM feature, maybe run the wizard, the management template, to do the basic configuration there. If you have a look at this agenda, you'll notice this is a pretty intense agenda. We've got a lot of line items to cover here. That being said, definitely maybe opt to take fewer notes. Watch us here. You're going to have the recorded session. You're going to have the PowerPoints you can always go back to. It's going to be fast. It's going to be fun. Any sad attempts at humor, and they will be sad, were orchestrated beforehand, so there are no feelings will be hurt in the making of this session. So let's start with, say, a 90-second overview of APM architecture in Ops Manager 2012. So the long and the short of it is the Avicode functionality that became APM has been integrated into the OM stack. So we're using a single agent, a single communication channel, and all of our configuration items are integrated into the Operations Manager console. That being said, the Avicode functionality, in a lot of ways, you'll see today, looks very much like it did in the Avicode timeframe.
Right. How many of you ever installed Avicode or then used APM? Oh, that's nice. Pretty awesome.
That's good news. And if you haven't, like we said, just go back and have a look at some of the sessions earlier in the week, and that'll catch you up on the architecture in an hour or two. Really, what we're going to be here to focus on today is to talk about how you can leverage the information in Avicode to drill down to what you need, what your support teams need, so you can begin to take that step from using the Avicode functionality APM in a troubleshooting context to more of a proactive conversation to drive positive change in your environment. So from an agent perspective, how does APM work? It works very much like much of the application monitoring we do today, right? The configuration that you put together through the management template is delivered down in a management pack to an agent. So the first time the agent loads that workflow and puts its hooks down to your application, we do have to do an IIS reset. That's how we get that basically lightweight profiler attached to the agent. The agent begins to listen the APM service, which you'll notice is installed with the agent, and it sends information back to the management server. Client-side monitoring, formerly UX, is a browser-based experience using JavaScript that's injected into the page to bring information back through the monitored server and back to the management server. So that's an agentless functionality that's just going to give us the other side of the equation in terms of user experience.
Wow, that was the fastest architecture overview I've ever seen.
And
awesome.
And that's not the only thing I do fast, but that's another story.
Awesome.
You just took that right to the gutter, didn't you? We're in Vegas, I expect that.
Right, so we want to help you to start where you probably are, like when you're using the Avicode or APM now to monitor several of your applications deployed to several servers. Some of your member teams are engaged. They are really excited. They fix your issues. And you really want to grow that. You want to install it to all of your applications, or most of them. You want to become more proactive on how you use the tool. And you want to engage multiple teams, multiple departments. So that's basically the journey we want you to help to go to. And one of the challenges that you experience there is how to engage many teams. And there are many teams that you have, and several of them really would benefit from having APM data leverage there. So first one is operations team, and those are IT pros. Like, how many of you are IT pros? Most of you, I guess? Very nice.
No shame in that.
Awesome. So pretty much it starts with you, because you deploy that, you configure it, and you want to know the high-level health of your applications. You want to see what's happening, if something is wrong, where exactly that failure happens. And then you want to pass the data to the support and development team. And they are pretty much the main consumers of the data, and they will benefit that most of that, because they need to know the call stack, the parameters passed, where the performance goes worse than others, those SQL queries. They will benefit most of that, and they will produce bug fixes, a new version out of these details. But also, in addition to that, there is a testing and QA team, and we saw quite a number of times during the implementations that these guys also benefit from the APM data, because first of all, it brings them root cause of the problem, so it helps them to reproduce the issue in the test environment. You know, it's really hard to figure out what customer clicked and did something wrong, or did something right, but the application didn't work properly. So it helps them to do the repro, and then later verify the fixes, and maybe even install the APM in the QA environment. And the last role, it's pretty new to the community, is DevOps role, but we've seen it quite a number of times. Basically, it's like, imagine if you have a developer, and you take him or her to the operations. So that person becomes responsible for the operational processes, for the health of the application, but he can speak the language like the developer speaks. He can look up the code, the source code. He can debug something, think about the fix. So he speaks both languages, but he's operational at the same point. Next challenge when you're bringing APM into your organization is how you integrate it with your processes, with your activities. And there are several activities. First one is basically troubleshooting. That's an easiest one, and you probably, I guess everyone who tried it, you notice that it's really powerful when you have good visibility into your application code. But next step, when you want to become more proactive, you really want to leverage the data in your daily, weekly meetings to start looking into some baselines, how it grows on, like what changes in your application behavior you noticed with the release, with just new sales on your website, anything. And then when you have all these reports, you really need to start focusing on fixing top problems. And isn't it what makes your application more available and performing better when you fix the most happening issue, right? But next you bring your architects. And when they're thinking about the next release, the scope of that, they also should look to the application behavior and problems that they have in the current version and leverage that the best way so they can build a new architecture that will work better, performing faster and failing less. And the last piece, which is, I guess, not the last in terms of importance, it's really to bring feedback from the development and support team to the operations environment with the configuration changes. So if somebody is missing some data, like developer says, I don't have enough information here in this stack, or maybe we should look a bit different, or maybe I just don't want to see that, help us improving the configuration so we can leverage it better. So it's really integrating across different processes, and making that happen would really help you to go further with the implementation. And also important point is the data that APM collects. And you probably heard from all the demos, like all these terms like namespaces, performance method, exception tracking functions. We'll go a little into that, and I'll try to explain you what it actually means and what it gives you. And a few additional topics, those are discovered there, like sensitive information and covering custom APIs.
Yeah, so Alex makes some really important points here. So today, a lot of us use APM for troubleshooting, right? Kind of a reactive sort of activity. And what he's really talking about here is taking APM, leveraging this data in a proactive way to do some fine-tuning, some advanced configuration, so we can drive conversations with our other support teams, like our developers, to begin to improve not only our monitoring processes, but we begin to make gain ground back into the development cycle. So that being said, there's no better place to start than with Application Advisor reports. So I want to take just a minute to talk to you about a handful of reports that are a great way for you to begin these conversations with your development teams and your weekly meetings to drive this sort of conversation. My favorite is the problem distribution report. This allows me to build a report, in a single report, the top problems in all of my applications. Now granted, different application support teams are going to have silos of responsibility, right? This report does make it pretty easy for us to filter down to just the applications that these teams are responsible for, and that's what it's all about. We want to give them a report that's relevant, that's actionable at all times. Application status is pretty nice for another reason. Application status allows us to compare the details of application performance from week to week. So this is going to be a fantastic report for you and your teams to be looking at on a weekly basis, so you get a good feel for what the baseline looks like. And then when we roll out a code release over the weekend, we can begin to compare behavior of the last release versus the new release to see what our performance baseline looks like, if it's good, or maybe not so good. And we're going to schedule that report every week.
Right, and the last point, I really like it. You want to schedule it and send to a responsible person, but not somebody who drinks coffee all the day, right?
Really?
Oh, Pete.
That's just wrong. Just wrong. And the last one I'm going to talk to you about, the application CPU utilization report. If you don't have any sort of detailed performance reporting on your applications in place today that you're shipping out through Operations Manager, this is a quick hit here to give you some visibility out of the gate. So that being said, why don't we just jump into our demo environment here, and I'll show you a little bit about my favorite report, Problem Distribution Analysis. So, by default, when I run this report, I'll pull this up and we'll just run a report for today and look at the problems with all of the applications. And then we're going to talk a little bit about scheduling. It's really important that we take time to schedule these reports, because we set it and forget it at that point. It becomes part of the conversation. Let me find F11 here for a little full screen action. Much better. And I'll just run a report for today. So we're going to look at the whole lot. This gives us a nice top X application problems. I'll just scroll down here and have a look. Looks like dinner now is showing some activity, and we'll just scroll down a bit and see what we have down here in the dinner now area. So it looks like in this case 90% of my problems are coming from the database. I can click into the report and now I can begin to see problems that exist in my environment here. So I'm going down into event data at this point and seeing details about what's happening within the application pretty easily. So let's talk about how we take this report and fine-tune it and schedule it. So how many of you are pretty familiar with Ops Manager in the room? I'm guessing quite a few. Good deal. So you guys know all about relative dates. So we want to schedule this report for a business cycle. So I'm generally speaking going to go first day previous week, last day previous week, and I'm going to run that report. I might want to filter down to some applications. If I go and I look at some of my sources here, you'll see that I can filter down to specific applications. I can get down to, say, just dinner now. I'll hit the apply button and just run this report so I see that it has the data that I'm expecting first. And there are many ways that I could schedule the report, but now that I've run the report, I see that it has the data I want, the relative dates. I can hit the schedule button. That's going to bring all of my selections, which are ready for me to move right into the scheduling process here. So I've got my relative dates and I've got my sources. I'm going to give this report some sort of descriptive name. You want to make sure you have a naming convention that includes the frequency, the application or applications, perhaps the support teams that you're sending that report to, because you will schedule quite a few of these in a large organization. So you want to be able to tell report A from report B from report C. And that is what reporting looks like in Advisor.
Right. Thank you. So next thing I really want to put a really good time on is to investigate the APM monitoring results flow. You will understand that, most of you think that the data goes really simple. It goes from the agent, from the collector, and it becomes either alert or it goes to up at the diagnostics and advisor console. Do you think so? It's not. There are basically two different ways to get the data to become alert or event in those consoles. And let's take a close look at each of those. So when the data goes to become an alert, there are four ways. There are four rules those are creating alerts based on the data the APM agent or collector for the client-side monitoring that creates it as an alert. And they're configured based on the aspect, which is either performance, application failure, connectivity, or security. And that's what is available in the wizard with the configuration. So on the top, you usually select if you want to create performance alert or exception alert. If you check you want to see exception alert, you're able to select which one aspect you want to see, security, connectivity, application failures.
But at this point, I'm just focused on configuring alerts, right?
Right. This is only alerts configuration, which means which alerts you're going to receive in the operations management console. And you can, if you want to see all of them, you'll be able to use like all your resources to see how many alerts you have, forward them to TFS, or maybe just go drill into the details, like all these things. But these are limited to the scope of operations manager. The next thing is like you enable same way the client-side monitoring, just either performance or exceptions for the client-side events. But when we look at really at the data, that's how it goes from the agent to the advisor and app diagnostics console, you can see that all events actually are transferred to these consoles. Why is it so? This is implemented pretty much to your benefits and to the development and supporting benefits. So when they are investigating an issue, they can see all the problems those were happening in your application. And maybe sometimes it's really related. Like it doesn't look so. Maybe some performance is related to some connectivity and to some failure within different components. So these guys, they will be mostly leveraging the diagnostics and advisor consoles. They'll be able to drill into that, just search group by that, filter by time, filter by components, and they'll be able to understand. So they have the full visibility in that. But really, if you have all the events, you should have a way to how to limit the number of those events. And this is available as rules. And rules is actually the mechanism that helps you with that. So why do we need it?
So why do we need rules? You know, the first time I ran this report, I remember being really excited to take this information to my developers. Now, as an IT pro, I've got something to say, and they're going to be pretty excited about this. And then reality sets in. I pull this report out, and I hear things like, that's nice, Pete, but this was fixed last week, so we don't care about that anymore. Yeah, we know about this one, too. It's fixed in pre-prod. We'll have it in production, so you don't need to tell us about this one either. You know, Pete, we don't even know how to fix this one. Maybe we'll fix that one next year so you can stop telling us about that as well. So rules are going to be our key for tuning the non-actionable data out of our reports so we keep a living, relevant, focused document in front of our developers. So why do we need rules? Well, we need to filter out noise. So if we have issues that are acknowledged, if we have bugs that are fixed, We want to set them and forget them, right? We just want those to fall out of the report. And this is something you're going to use every day because as the conversation continues and you get your developers more actively involved with your APM deployment, I promise you they're going to be coming back to this console every day. So they're going to be asking you, how can I make this go away? As you crawl back into QA with your APM monitoring, the test team, they're going to want to tune out some of that noise. So how do you start? Start with the top-level problems, right? Go look at that problem distribution analysis report and just start filtering from the top down. We take the worst off, and we just attack the problem in layers.
Right. So what is a rule? Basically, the rule is a set of conditions and actions. And the way how it works, APM agent sends the event to the console. Against each event, you have a set of rules, and each time it's evaluated if the event matches the criteria which you put as conditions in the rule. And if it matches, you apply the action. And there could be different conditions. Some of them are general, like your application name or your computer name or a type of a problem, like failure or performance issue. And some of them are more specific to be either exception or performance. An exception will include things like call stack, exception class. Performance will include like response time and all those things. And the actions, those are available for you. You can change the status of the event, of each individual event. And the statuses there are new. and use the one which you have right now. All events are new for you if you don't ever configure it rules. Then you can set Revute, and Revute is assumed as something like acknowledged. I already know what it is. I don't want to see it anymore. I want to filter by that, but I still want to have it in my database. And the two rest are deleted and by design. So these will change the lifetime of the events if they match the rules which you defined, and they have different lifetimes, so you still have a chance to go back and review your data to make sure this actually is right, and you don't want to really hide any important data by these rules, like any stuff which is actually an issue, but not a noise. So exception problems, as I mentioned, they have really criterias relevant to exception details, like call stack, exception class, failed function, so very relevant to exceptions. And performance is the same. It contains filters based on the action. An action is the URL which you hit, or the web service or WCF method that runs slow, the duration of that. And resource call, which is the slowest method in your stack, like slowest SQL query that caused the most of the degradation, or maybe the slowest method of your own code, and the duration of that, so you can create a condition based on it.
So as I look at the performance and exception rules, Alex, I notice that the check boxes allow me to select multiple options. So I guess that allows me to define more specific filters for specific types of failures, yeah?
Exactly. You need to really be granular with that and pick up only the criteria together, like they've related as and, this one and this one and this one, to match only the subset of the issues those are which you want to mask, like the noise or acknowledge problem. And you don't want to include occasionally anything which is important, which doesn't belong to this problem. So let me go to do a quick demo to spend a bit more time on how you do this. Okay, I'm canceling this one. And we'll need to run, rules are available from the application diagnostic console, so we'll run this one.
And to be really clear here, Alex, you're going to be filtering events, not alerts, right?
That's absolutely correct. So we're talking about events and events and actually individual violation, either caused by exception or something running slow over the threshold. So I'll just start with like this top failure which I have. And I already communicated to my development team. So they say that when this failure of the type SysML reference exception, if it happens in this method, in the show order method, that's because they deploy the wrong DLL occasionally, and every time the user hits it, he gets that exception. So I really want to filter all the pages in an application who really hit that method and throw that exception. I really to filter it out, but not forever. I want to filter it out till June 1st, when they promise to have a new release on the production. So they have relevant data in the reports. So what I really want to do, there are multiple ways to create a rule. I really want to encourage you to do that starting from the event, because when you do it from the event itself, you run the rules management wizard, and I'll do the empty template to show you all the properties. You can learn other templates when you have time. But here, when I select any of the criteria, what happens, like I mentioned, I have null reference exception. That's exception class. I want to filter by that. So when I check this, it pre-fills the filter condition from the event where I opened it from. So I don't have to copy-paste and retype and mistype something. So I want to do exception class, that's null reference exception. The failed function, that's the place the exception was raised, which identifies my module. So that was zero now show order, right? And I really need to limit the scope of this to be in the same source, which is my application zero now, because that's where the developers are claiming the exception is. And I want to do event type. Which is exception, right? It's not a performance issue. And pretty much it. Maybe I want to include computer here if it's relevant only to a specific environment. Actually, let me do this.
And Alex, I can't help but notice as an IT pro, you've got a lot of .NET-ish stuff on the screen there. How am I going to know that all of this filtering is going to apply in the way that I expect it to?
That's absolutely a valid question. So next thing I really want everybody to do, when you create this filter, probably together with your developers, with their help, you click this show preview. And this is important because it shows you all the events, those match the criteria from the applications already being monitored. So you have all this stuff. You can review that this is all good. You can drill into each detail. But really, the thing you're looking at, you don't want to have anything which doesn't belong to this description, to these criteria in this list. So you don't want to occasionally hide a real problem. And you may even revisit this time to time by checking like events which has like by design status or Revit status to see that everything is correct there. So you do this, you verify that everything is correct. So next thing you want to do, you want to set up my change status. So as I mentioned, I really want to hide this from reports, but I really don't want to dismiss this issue completely. So I'll mark it as reviewed, right? So I acknowledge that. I know that it happens, but I will be able to filter by that status. So next thing, I really need to create a nice naming for the report. And imagine you will have 50, maybe 100 rules. You really need to distinguish one from another one. So you want to tell like null ref problem of date, and excuse me for some misspelling, like sort of date that. Then you want to put a note like, since dev team communicated back to me, they probably have an issue ID. So I put like bug number 456. So if I go look deeper, I will always get back to developers and know what they're talking about, right? And then important thing is to set the expiration date here. Expiration date is literally expiration date, when this rule will expire. And we were talking about release on June 1st, so I'll put June 2nd as an expiration date. So if after the release this issue is still happening, it will appear as new again, and it will be all in my reports. If everything's fixed, we're all good, right? And I want to apply it to existing events. That's just to have all the reports pre-filtered. Is it a quick question? No, the rule is not deleted after the expiration date. You can go and revisit that. So it's going to be expired, but it's not going to be deleted, the rule itself. So it's going to be available. So for instance, if the release schedule didn't work, they're going to do it on July 1st, you can go revisit that and re-enable it.
And that's critical, because we can flag that in a way that if the fix doesn't happen and it drops off the expiration, then the event comes back up in our reports.
Okay, so next thing is very easy, apply that. Here's my preview of my criteria, the filter. So everything is good to go.
And so I can take that back to my problem distribution report, where if I only want to run a report on new events, I can restrict that to the new category and keep that very actionable and very relevant for my different support teams and on back to my developers.
Right. So just make the reports live using that. And if you ever hear something like, I know about this, just let's do something about it. Let's hide it. Like if you really acknowledge that, show me your bug number and we hide it here. Actually, you know what? Let me show you a little thing that's important. I didn't show you that. Sorry about that.
You've got them excited, people.
Yeah. That's too bad. Slow me down. So here, first thing, you have status filter. By default, it's new and reviewed, like deleted by design are not there. And the same is available in advisory reports. So you uncheck your reviewed. And now you will not see, I didn't apply the rule, so we still see these things. But now you will see all new issues. When you subscribe to a report, like Pete showed previous demo, you intentionally select only new, or maybe you want to see all the things happening. Then you intentionally leave new and reviewed, and maybe all of them. That was important. On current slide. Awesome.
All right.
So a little bit more talking here. As I promised, I really want to drill into some explanation, like friendly talking about what these performance namespaces actually do, what they bring to you, exception tracking, these methods. And I do it really simple. I have a few screenshots here. This is the screenshot about the performance monitoring. So we have a performance violation. I don't have any performance namespaces enabled. So as you notice, we have only the system level methods like WCF, link, SQL. I don't have any source code, right? I don't have my code here, which is not fair. My code is also running slow, right? So when you enable performance namespace, this is what appears to you. And you have your own performance code with names of the methods and the duration. In this case, you may not need that, because you know that the slowest part was WCF. But if you have a slowness within the code itself, you definitely want to look for enabling these namespaces to be monitored for performance. Next thing I really wanted to cover is performance methods. And performance methods are the methods where we collect, and I apologize, I'm saying we, because I feel so attached to AviCode and APM. It's not my product anymore. But here we have junior null method without parameters, and you can tell it by the triangle on the left. You can expand it. When you have the UI available, you can expand it. And there is no triangle, so it means no parameter were collected. So when I enable that particular method to be a performance method, I can see that I have all the parameters collected here now, like new order object, all the properties here, like all the stuff is collected here. So that's available if you have a violation of the performance and that method is included in the call stack, you can see the parameter values.
So when we're looking at these methods and these namespaces, Alex, it would be real easy for me to just enable this for all the namespaces and methods in my custom code. Is that a good way to approach it?
Not exactly. For the performance methods, since it's collecting the parameter values, it's sort of intense and may introduce some overhead if you really enable it for all of them. So the approach here is to enable it for more like resources. Those are critical to troubleshoot, and you need to know the parameter values. Maybe this one wasn't the best shot, right? But when you have a method that talks to some external component, like some web service or database, though standard communication to web services, databases, WCF, all the stuff is already covered. But if you really have your own custom functionality, and you need to know the parameter values in order to troubleshoot the performance issue, that's the methods you want to consider to be a performance methods in your configuration. And the last piece is exception tracking function. You probably heard that too. So here, let me bring both of them. If you noticed, in the methods for the junior null namespaces on the top, on the left slide, you don't have two icons. Left is P, if you see that. P icon means parameter. S icon means the source code. So there is no P icon on the left when I didn't have any exception tracking namespaces enabled. But on the right, I have parameters passed. And that's really valuable for the developers to troubleshoot the failures so they know which parameters were passed to the code from the end user and which were passed within my own code to my own methods, and that caused to have a failure. So knowing that may actually improve the troubleshooting process. Question?
Hold that for about 15 minutes.
Maybe
less.
Got
you covered. Maybe less.
Right. So where to configure all of this stuff? It's available from the wizard since VCode functionality is fully integrated and all of the configuration is available from the operations manager. That's part of the wizard. So you switch to advanced settings here in the server default client-side monitor, server-side monitoring defaults. You switch to advanced and you click set namespaces for performance namespaces. You click set methods for the performance methods when you want to collect a parameter value. And you click exception tracking for the exception tracking list. So that's available for you as a central point of configuration. You set it up. You try it next. You monitor your application. You see what's collected after that.
So let's talk about filtering out data that's a little bit sensitive. So Alex, I couldn't help but notice in your demo that I saw things like social security numbers and credit card numbers and birthdays. Things that we might not want to show outside certain groups of people, or in some cases, maybe nobody at all, right? Sometimes we have compliance initiatives. If you work for a financial, a healthcare, or a bank, you will be sensitive about this sort of thing. So we have to figure out, do we need to filter it out at all? And you'll probably already know the answer to that question right out of the box. So we can ask ourselves some questions to get to the yes or no answer there. So does our application use PII data? Well, when you execute a transaction, do you have a field for credit cards, for Social Security, for birthdays, etc.? Then yes, we've got PII data there, right? Is it collected by APM? Do we see this information surfacing in the events in our reports? And if so, who has access to that data within our environment? So if we look at that really from a role-based perspective, we have sensitive data not only surfacing in the APM interface itself within Ops Manager, but we have sensitive data back in our infrastructure, right? It lives back there in the databases and the servers within our applications. A data center admin might have access to all of that information, and that might be okay. As we move along the support stack, then we get into the APM users, maybe QA testers, maybe developers. Who can see that data in the APM interface. It may be entirely possible for developers to troubleshoot a problem without seeing the sensitive data itself, and we'll talk about the layers there that are possible. When we get down to, say, Tier 1, Tier 2 support in the NOC, vendors, we know those are folks we absolutely don't want seeing personally identifiable information about our customers, right? So we want folks to have the information they need to solve problems, but not to have the information they need to go shopping. So if we want to implement some data access controls, we have three options with varying degrees, varying levels of precision. We could start with role-based access. So with Active Directory and role-based security and Ops Manager, there is an APM role that I can use to turn visibility to APM data on and off for support folks in my environment. I could take that a step further and begin to limit my data collection. So I could configure my exception and performance monitoring settings to filter out some of those areas where I know sensitive data is going to surface. Or I can take it all the way in terms of granularity, and I can look at advanced data filtering. That means I'm going to bring all of that information from my custom namespaces and methods in, but I'm going to mask out those sensitive areas. So I'll put a cover over my social security number, my credit card information.
Right, and when we take a look closer to these regex-based sensitive data filters, like, just let me put it this way. First of all, here's an event which I noticed in my database, and includes really a long string which contains several things, but it also contains a social security number, which is not my social security number, but it's still sensitive, right? But the developers told me that they really need to know the other parameters from this long string, and the security guys are telling me I really need to take the social security number off. So to address this challenge, you really can create a regex which identifies which part of this string you need to address. And this is expression and compare expression. Usually they are equal to each other. One used to detect where we need to actually do something, and the expression is to identify what was the part of the string we really need to substitute. Then the replacement tells me I want to replace it with stars. And the type of that is value, because we're looking into the value of the big string. I really want to take care of just part of that. So when I apply that to my system, to my APM monitoring configuration, that's what I have. Isn't what we wanted to see. Like, social security is masked. All the parameters which developers wanted to see for troubleshooting are there. So everything is good. How it looks, how to really apply that. You need to put an XML in the following format where you specify, again, your expression, compare expression, replacement, and type of the hidden rule. And when you put this and apply this to your settings in this format, it's going to work. Another sample. I have a bit different data structure. And you really need to think about teamwork here. It's not like operations people will think about this like in created by the samples. You take your developers, you take your architects, you sit together and review the data and create these filters because they know more about like how they structure the data. Is it part of the string? Is it part of the fields of some class? Like here, I have parameters class, and one of the fields is social security number. So I really need to get rid of all of this, just the whole parameter, the whole field here. For that, it's even more simple. I create an expression which just literally matches the name of a field, and the type is field. You can also do all if you create a really advanced rule to address both value and field base. I really want to keep them separate because I'm not that fan of the regexes. I always read some little page how to do that every time I'm doing this.
You're not a fan of regex. Do we have any fans of regex in here? Oh, shut up.
I appreciate you guys. Nice. So when we apply that, this is what we're going to have. Social security is masked. All the other fields are there, as my development or support team ask me for. They want to know data stuff because it's relevant to their troubleshooting process, but the sensitive data, the social security number, is masked. And the pin rule expression here is fairly simple. It has only expression and the type, and you put this, again, in this XML format. You apply it, and next time the event comes here, it doesn't work on the existing events. Only when the next event comes, it's going to be filtered by these regex rules. So how to apply it? It's basically using the same operations manager objects and overrides which you used to use. So you find this rule, apply APM agent configuration of this class. You override the value for the sensitive data rules, and you put all your XML-based hidden rules in one line XML and put that as an override, like this. So you'll have something looking very much like this one, like apply APM rule, here's my override, I'm good.
Well, so now you're speaking my language. So if I can create an override, I can use an XML sample with my devs.
Exactly.
To control that. And how am I going to target that override? Can you show us in your demo, maybe?
Exactly. So here, let me start with this overrides already. I'm on rules. I limited scope to activated APM agent only. So I have my apply APM agent configuration. And this is when I want to do, let's go to properties. Just, I mean, any way you want to navigate through here. And I want to do overrides, and I want to override, let's say, for every object here. And here's my sensitive. Where is it? Here's my sensitive, and I already have some value here. It's not really nice to edit it from here. You copy it, you edit in your Notepad++ or whatever you use for that, and then put it here. So that's very easy. Let me show you a bit more example, because I know configuring some sensitive data is really complicated subject. Let me show you a few examples. And I exported for that. I exported just a few events to show you like the full story, which I haven't, which steps I had to take in order to comply with my security requirements. So that annoying running ActiveX control, it can appear when we export the event and save it locally. Sorry for that. So here I have a performance event. And it looks very good. And I see that this one method process order, it accepts new order parameter. So I go deeper in that. I see that new order object has some values. I look through that. And username is OK. This address is OK. But really, payment method doesn't look very promising and right. I have a credit number field here. So that's my credit card number. And I'm required to hide it from you, right? So the first thing I want to do, I don't want to go to these regex rules. Like, really, I'll do pretty nice thing. You remember, to collect the parameters in the method, we really need to specify that as a performance method, right, in my wizard. So if you remember our data collection story, so if I go to the authoring, to the templates, just my .NET application monitoring, to dinner now, that's where you specify these performance methods, and that's where you, that's what I want to do, basically. I want to go to advanced settings, here to the set methods, and I see, okay, I have a bunch of those, so I want to either remove it or edit it and disable parameters collection, which I already did, because I exported the events to show you. But that's like the easiest way to do, even without creating a regex. So maybe developers will complain that they're missing some nice parameters, and it's always a discussion that you'll have to have. But really, do they need it or not? Really need to think about the troubleshooting process. So they don't need it, or maybe I just did it by myself. I never asked anybody. So let's go to the other event here. So when I scoped the configuration, I applied that change, and I have it's not collecting the parameter values for this method. Here you see I cannot expand it. It has no triangle. But I'm looking further into this, and I see that, oh, it calls WCF. And I need to check what kind of parameters I'm passing to the other component over the wire. And my bad, it looks like it accepts new order object as well. And that's my payment field here. And it still contains my credit card. So the challenge here is that this method, which is used to call WCF, I cannot address it just to tweak the parameters collections, because that's coming out of the box. That's the standard coverage for all the standard communication protocols in .NET. So I really have to create a regex rule. So now I can go back to my developer. And together with him, we create this rule, which looks really similar as we showed on the demo. I have card number field, which was the field in the event. And I want to filter everything just because it's the field. I want to get rid of that value completely, right? And the end result is when we applied this rule to the system. So let me open that. Here's my WCF. Parameters, new order, payment field. Here it is. Everybody can see that? Magic. Now I'm good to go for my security requirements.
So incidentally, that sample will be available for download with the PowerPoint and the deck, so you'll be able to jump in with both feet and begin to configure PII data on your own. So let's shift gears and talk about aliasing. So what is an alias? I actually know the answer to this. An alias is something I use with TSA when I'm at the airport.
Exactly.
So alias, what aliasing is in APM terms is a way to put a friendly name on our exception data so I can filter and group at a more granular level in my report. At the end of the day, I want a report that's living and active, but I also want it to be very precise. I want to give all of the information about the frequency and the impact of a specific type of failure in a single report so I minimize my developer's time digging around. So let's take a simple example here. I have a SQL, an execute scalar function here that that runs queries. So if I were to group on a method, which you could really apply to any method in your custom code, you see here that I have errors related to any number of queries in my environment. Now, I really want to drill down on something more specific. There's going to be a lot of digging here to get down to find the frequency and the impact of this particular issue. Now, on the other hand, if I create an alias, and in this case, maybe I could just alias on the query itself, now I can group on something much more specific, and I can show in a single report all the occurrences of a specific type of error. So it gives me instant drill down into the frequency and the impact and minimizes my developer's time.
So really, do I need to take care of the SQL queries when I install APM monitoring?
And that's actually a really good question. What I've shown you here is a bit of a cheat. We use this as an example because it's something that's very familiar to us as System Center folks working with databases, right? This particular bit of aliasing is covered out of the box with APM, so this sort of clever alias back to the query is done for you, and you don't really have to worry about it, as I've demonstrated here.
So, yeah, let me continue on this example using the system the execute scalar from the system framework. And really, what we will see in the performance event if our application uses SQL queries, if you expand the parameters, you will notice that there is execute scalar method available, so you can see it. But then you can see that the value of the query name is actually one of the parameters, cmdtext. Please remember this cmdtext because we'll use it at the next slide. So we're taking the value of this cmdtext and display that as a description of the method with some friendly prefix like SQL column. So now, when I have everything displayed like this, I have all the queries distinct, so I can group by them. My reports will show like the slow performance points related to the specific query. I will be able to search by that. I will be able to group by that in the diagnostics console as well as the advisor. So that's what we want to have for these kind of APIs. And to configure it, it's very similar in terms of like it's also an XML, really simple XML. So if you follow this, oh, somebody changed the format in here. Oh,
thank
that's bad.
Silver box.
Yeah, we'll visit them and say thank you. So here you have three things.
I'm gonna take it out of presentation mode. These slide decks go through a minor formatting change when they leave our hands.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
Yeah. No worries. So we'll touch that with the editors and make sure you get an appropriately highlighted version.
Right. So basically, there are three things I wanted to show you. First one is the name of the method, and you see that there is execute scalar. That's the method for which you are creating an alias, and that's something like call to SQL which you want to address. Then the alias description is in the middle. And it contains my text, my prefix, how I want to see it, so I will be able to search for all SQL calls, for instance. And then it contains, like, in the brackets, 0, which means I'm referring the primary value here, and the primary name is cmdtext. So going back again to this, that's too much, cmdtext. You see it here, cmdtext. That's what I'm referring here in the alias description.
Okay, so just real quick on here, the three pieces you're going to configure are right here, your method, your alias here with the parameter 0, and then you see our parameter name. Now, Alex, just to give you a question while we're here, I see that parameter 0. What if I wanted to configure multiple parameters? Is that possible?
That's a good question. And sometimes it's actually required. So you can specify multiple parameters. Just make sure you put them in the right order, and the order can be any order. But you need to refer them from 0, 1, 2, starting how they appear in this description, not in the event, but in this alias definition. So you use that. You can even apply the regex. So if you don't want to see the full value of the parameter, you want to see just a substring, you can create a regex. But it's pretty advanced. But I saw it was required once in my life, but that's available. A little bit on how to apply that. That's fairly simple. Pretty much same rule in the same class. You write a different property, LS in rules. You put that as a same single line XML containing all your functions following the template, and that's going to be applied to the agents. Like this. Very, very easy if you follow the steps and you don't tweak the template. A little time to spend on discussing how you really want to do it and when. So, like, you don't want to turn every method to be LS, right? So the recommendation basically is really similar to the methods where you want to enable the parameters collection. So the methods, those are touching another resource. So, like, few questions to ask yourself if you want to create an LS. First one, is the execution of the method really dependent on the parameter value? So for SQL, it's really like that. You put one query, it runs super fast. You put another query, it just fails. And you put third query, it runs 30 seconds. And for me, it's really relevant. So if you have methods in your own API, and I mean, if you're talking to your development team, just ask them the same questions, if they really have that. And then also, if it makes sense, more sense for you to group and filter and search by the primary values more than just by the method name, so it's going to be more distinct, then probably right. Probably you want to create an LS for such a method. And that's the discussion you want to have, and that's the definition you want to create together with them.
So I think what you're telling me here is I need to first focus on methods that are relatively constant. So they're going to be around for an extended period of time. And I think you're saying also to focus on methods that are maybe making calls to external sources like databases and web services and...
Right, right. But web services and WCF services and SQL services are already covered. So make sure you check that you don't have it here. Maybe if your some code calls a web service using standard API, you're covered because that will display the friendly LS for the web service already. But if you have something that you are talking to, like, I don't know, my old retired some database which is not consuming the standard protocol or something like that, maybe you need to consider doing that. And also important, as you call it, static, like static methods. You don't want to spend time LSing the methods. Those will be gone next release, like in several months, because you want to have some consistency in your reports. So you have like information about your typical behavior that changes over time, and you see like these calls, they go away, they are fixed, but these calls, they appeared, and they introduce more failures. So you don't want to spend time LSing on the code that's changing. You really want to consider some sort of APIs or frameworks, maybe developed internally, maybe downloaded from the internet, to maybe LS those. And next one, I really want to demo that to you. And I will use same way. I don't want to show you where to override it. It's really the same place, just a different override value. I want to show you several exported events. And that's a little bit long story. 8 shots here. Just bear with me. I'll try to explain it really carefully here. So first event is like something where I noticed I was troubleshooting my application. I was really looking where I spend more performance, where I have problems. And I noticed that I have a method. Let me collapse. This is fast. This is fast. And here's my slow path. I have some social invoke external method, which is good. Okay, we have 3 seconds there. We can talk to these guys who maybe... Like, if it's my external vendor, really, what do we do there? But what I noticed, that the call comes from the getUpdates method. So I really wanted to see what other methods are calling this invoke external. So having this on, which is getUpdates, I really found another method. So when I expand this, I really see that it is also invoke external, but it's called from the send message. So different methods are calling same API sort of thing. So that's looking interesting. And I talked to the development team, and they said, really, this looks like the API actually uses this one method for all the queries to my external social API framework, to my external web service. So the next thing I did, I created a definition in the performance method to collect parameters for that invoke external method. So I really wanted to see what parameters we are passing on. So not so fancy change, just added one method to be collecting parameters there. And same two events collected, but already with parameter values. So I'm going here, get updates internal. And now I have this triangle, meaning I have the parameter values. So I expand that. I see, oh, very nice, operation get updates. Some values into this. OK, that's my account, my hash code. You don't want to see that. And some of the parameters, OK, it looks like the daytime. So this call accepts one of the values, like get updates, which seems to be related to the actual method of the call which the developers are calling, like getUpdates. It's public method that they're using. So I want to really confirm that by monitoring the other event. So I enabled it on for a while and waited until I have the performance issue in this WCF submit order. And what I see here, that actually confirms my theory that I have operation send message.
You're going to alias and group all of these social API problems together?
Exactly. I want really to group by the operation now because it makes more sense. Because maybe what I want to see, and that's what my developers are telling me, that these operations are not equal. They may run with different response time. They may fail differently. So I really want to track them separately. I really want to have distinct report that would show me each operation one by one. It's because they're calling it that way. And it's sort of a hard exercise to do by yourself. So really engage in some development team, which know the frameworks they're using will really help. So what I created here is an alias. And the alias is really the way as we discussed. So I put the name of the method, which is invoke external, with the full namespace, class name, and the brackets here. And I created an alias looking like social API prefix, so I can filter by that to see all my social API calls. But I want to see the parameter value with operation value of the operation field here in the definition. So it's going to be either send up, get updates or send message. And next, I have two more events where I already applied alias, responding to the same default page and WCF call.
OK, so at this point, you've taken that XML and created the override, and this is the result, yeah?
Right, exactly. I already applied that. And again, this doesn't work for the old issues. It works only for the new coming data. So for that, I see the result. This is social API get updates. That's how I want to see it, how I want to look for that, search and filter by that. And I still have access to the details. This is my invoke external method as it was. And all the parameters, they are still there. So that's only the way how to change the representation of the data in order to leverage it like more distinct for the functionalities like calls to another systems. Like if you're using same API to execute multiple calls, bring this parameter on, use the alias for that. And that's going to be what basically will allow you to group by that in the report. And here's my social API send message, the other method, just to confirm that everything works as designed.
So you notice up there in his label now, he has social API and the method, which means we can filter down very easily to a new level of granularity. So where before the report on the method would have shown me all the social API problems, now we're filtering down to a unique report for each method, which the developers told us were not equal operations. So we've, again, streamlined the report and allowing our devs to drill down without all the digging.
Right, and I exported the report just to show you the value of that. I exported the report for the performance of the DRNL application, and now I can see these methods, get updates and social API listed here, but they have unequal response time. One is running for over than 3 seconds, the other one is running for 1:34. So now I can complain really precisely to my vendor, who I'm calling to get this get updates method, to tell to improve that, because my application is running slow due to that. On average, it's over than 3 seconds, just planning in that API. And this method runs fine. It's OK. Does it make sense?
Makes sense, yeah. Yeah. So we're going to have some time for questions. So if we need to drill down, the good news is we're doing great on time. So we'll be able to dig in. So
right,
so
we'll have just a few more slides, and we'll be able to drill into the questions with you. So few important points I really wanted to edit here against the last two presentations on the sensitive data fillers and against the aliases. This is really part of the core functionality. That's why you don't see that in the UI in the wizards. And you're not considered to be changed that every day. But if you need to, you can do that because that's available as an override. But really be careful of that. So what I do by myself when I do this, I really, first thing I do, I limit the scope when I apply this rule. So I don't want to apply these overrides initially to all of the servers, to all of the instances of my APM activated agent. I want to limit it by the server name. And it's better be a test server. So this is first thing. Try it on your test box first. Second thing, remember, this is a rule. It's not applying the configuration right away once you create an override. Make sure you check that this the new configuration, new global snapshot event in the event log appeared. So you see that it applied all the new configuration. Wait a little bit. And then run your application to make sure you generate new events and then check them out. And the last thing, check operations manager event log also for errors. Because if you misspell something, if you put some wrong character in this XML definition, it may not always show up in the operations manager alerts, but it definitely will be part of the errors in the event log on the specific machine where you're trying that on. So really be careful with this topic. It's really important. We know you want to hide some sensitive data, and create aliases is rarely requested, but sometimes it happens when you're utilizing some external APIs, some maybe old components. You want to cover that. But really be careful when you're applying that and follow precisely the examples that we have here.
Okay, so know your target. Try it out on a server first and check the operations manager event log on that server if things don't go as planned and we can't do much harm that way. So great tips, Alec. So how do we get started with APM, folks? Go back to your environments. You know, if you're running APM on a limited basis right now, start running that problem distribution analysis report. Send it to your developers. Take it to the weekly meeting. Start the conversations. When developers see this sort of information, they get hungry for it pretty quickly, and it can start a new collaborative dialogue that might not exist in your environment today, and certainly in an operational sense, it's going to be a mutually beneficial relationship. You're going to give them information, and they're going to give you information about how you can improve and better target your monitoring strategy. And take it another step. If you're monitoring a couple of applications today, maybe look at adding a few more .NET applications in there to get some visibility across your environment. Even if that's only on a few servers, as we get more applications involved, we get more of our development team involved, it's going to drive that collaborative process across teams. So I hope today Alex has shown you a bit about how to take what you know about the features of APM and apply those as part of a process in your live environment.
Really, what I want to add here is that Microsoft did a really great job to integrate the AviCode functionality into the Ops Manager, so you have same product, same wizards, really extended configuration available for you there, and it's really easy to start. But as any other sophisticated tool, it's hard to push it across the organization. So I hope these tricks and tips and directions will guide you through that process with less pain.
And with that, we have some time for questions. I think about 12 minutes until they kick us off stage. So if you have questions, step up to the mic. If not, we sure appreciate all your time and attention. Fill out an eval when time allows. As we sure appreciate your feedback. So thanks again.
Thank you.
I have a question. What is the performance overhead on the agent?
Monitoring. .NET versus Java.
Don't
so
hear because Peter's too loud.
Let's
do questions by mic.
What's that?
Have questions. Let's do questions by mic so everybody hears. Maybe that's important.
Okay. Yeah, so the question was how much is the .NET monitoring like Java? It's conceptually similar, but the underlying architecture is different. So the Java monitoring uses a BeanSpy, a little JMX extender, to capture that information, intercept that information down within the application. So to me, when I look at the comparative stacks, it's functionally doing the same thing. It's an agent with no discernible impact to throughput or overhead on the machine?
I would add a little bit more than that. I would say Java is really on the way to start there. Like, I know there is a technology based on Avico technology to collect all the root cause there, but as I remember right now, you have a little less information. Like, it's more related to the performance metrics, like all this overall information, and you don't have full visibility in the call stack, like parameter values, like full the stack with the performance of each method. So I think that's where the Java stands right now as current release.
Yeah, Pei, what's Pei's full name? I just know it's Pei. Pei did a great session, the .NET and Java overview. If you actually go back and go through that, Pei did more than an overview of Java. She went pretty deep into that. Did you? Cool.
What is the performance overhead of the agent when it does performance monitoring, exception monitoring?
We noticed that during our implementations, more than even in the lab, that it's really bit, like around 5% overhead on the CPU, and it's pretty much the same throughput. Like if you're not running lack of your resources, if you have some free space on the memory on that, it's going to be mostly on the CPU, like around 5%.
Okay. And one more question. What is the largest implementation that that you've seen or been involved in as far as transactions per second?
So far, my largest one was at Xbox when they even were just a customer before the acquisition. And as I know, that grew up to about 1,000 nodes. But as I know, performance testing for the system tier 2012 was about 700 or 800 nodes. So I think that that's related to the largest implementation, more or less.
Do you remember what the transactions per second were on that, roughly?
Do you have any idea how many users are clicking Xbox? Like, I want to play the game. That's enormous. Okay. I don't remember really the number, but it was really impressive.
If you give us a card, we'll connect you with the right folks on the product team that can maybe get you some tap numbers.
Okay.
If you want to get some specific numbers, just drop us a card or an email.
Okay.
Is client-side monitoring invasive to the app? Does it depend? It injects something into the app.
Client-side monitoring, basically it works the way that since server-side monitoring is already in place, server-side has already hooks into the CLR. It has a hook for the method which produces the output HTML, and before sending it out to the wire, it injects the JavaScript.
Have you seen it break applications? You're injecting stuff.
We saw that initially like 2 years ago when it was just like first version. Now it's pretty stable, though I can suggest to you from my experience just to try it first, maybe on your like pre-staging environment, right? Yeah, there is a compatibility. Right, yeah, thanks, Daniel. Right. Right, so there are several limitations. So it does the IL code check, it checks the SPX code. So that's compatibility check that takes care of most of the issues. If you don't want to enable it globally, there are filters by IP addresses. So you might limit it to this segment, then expand it to this segment. So just bring it like one piece by one, just to make sure that everything's right. But it should be taken care of this release, and it was pretty stable for last year.
Okay, I have a question. We implemented Ivy code before. You know, that implementation is centered along Ivy code server and the install agent everywhere, right? And I saw the demo for the SC 2012. It looks like we can do from central place for everywhere. So when we do the upgrade to migrate from this Ivy code implementation to this new platform, and what's the best way? Do we need to destroy everything, and we have to? Because in this agent, we implement a lot of rules, monitor rules, the .NET entry code.
Right.
Then for the SC12, how can we do the?
Yeah, let me ask Daniel from the product team to address that question.
We'll get Daniela up to the mic here. We can get the official word.
So answer from me. I'm one of the VMs working on the feature. So we have a page which, if you search for notes for Avicode 5.7 customers, will pop up. If you search on Google and Bing, it's in one page on TechNet, and he has instructions on how to deal with upgrade. Essentially, we don't migrate the data, but we can have the two environments coexist for a while. you either have the AV code agent or you have the APM agent. So when you have the AV code agent already in place, when you install Ops Manager 12, the APM piece will not be deployed, just the health service, let's say. Just the Ops Manager piece will be deployed in that case, and you stay still with the previous AV code piece in place. When you're ready to remove it, then you can add back the new functionality. So the old agent will keep talking to the old infrastructure and report to the old server and database. You can essentially do a staged fashion migration. You can roll out in phases. We don't automatically migrate the settings. We don't automatically migrate the data. You will have to configure the new agents and the same applications with the new agents, but you can move gradually. Sure, that's why you can do it. You can do it in phases, one application at a time.
Daniela, will you repeat the question for us on the last bit there?
Oh, the last question is, do we have to redo the configuration we have already done? Well, essentially, yes, but it's still it's very consistent and similar configuration. You take what you have already done and you configure it in the new wizard.
Right. What I can add here, that you have with, like in the integration, there are the same terms, like namespaces, exception tracking functions, resources are performance method now, so if you have that, you most likely have it pretty much similar to all your servers, to all your applications, so you can take it and put into your new wizards. So it shouldn't be a really hard process.
Okay. Yeah, at the end of it, the language is all really the same, isn't it? So.
Exactly.
Yep.
So this is not a product, but just implementation. Maybe you have some ideas. We separate our QA and dev people and production completely. So we're actually running AV code for a while. We're not using all the features, but our development still has no access to it. So it's how do you deal with those issues where, I mean, I know you can email, I think, and you can export out, but how do we give them live access without accounts? So they don't get access to production and...
As I know,
have you seen that?
Can check with Daniel, but as I know, it's not allowed to do like separate thing. Like you want to have access to part of your application, and you want to limit access to the other part of the application. Mm-hmm. I think it's not allowed in 2012 version. If you want to all of them report to the same management server, I think you cannot do that granular access. You may have a separate Ops Manager server in your testing lab, then you will just have to take care of the access to that server. That's a good question. Most of them actually do, like, or some of the developers. So they treat them like kind of senior developers, and they actually do that. They give them access to the production. The question was, do we want to give access to the developers to the production data or not, and how we really limit that? So it's not possible to limit that too much. So you pick up. Developers seem if they don't want to do it really wide by some leads or seniors, and they have access there. And then, like as you go through, you implement more like sensitive rules, or you tune the collection to not collect sensitive data. It's all, I know that's a tough question, but literally, what we saw during the validation that sometimes they just have access to production environment, to the application database. So why do you care about the sensitive data in the Ops Manager when they have access to the database with complete data?